Chief Sattis, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 28th, 1984. I apologize first off for almost being late. I know I put a little stress on William. I did the best I could, but isn't it good to be sober? As Marion read a while ago, it's too big for us without help. But there's a room full of help here. And my God is with me, too. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it was like was pure D hell. I started at the age of 13, and my trouble started the same time my drinking, as I remember it now. First off, I should say that when I talk, I try to be very careful, because there are just several years of my life that I have no recollection of. I've had many blackouts, and some things I remember, some things I've been told, but I'm assuming that it's all are very close to the truth. When I was, I'll say probably 15, my parents took me to two different doctors, and they told me that if I did not slow down or stop drinking, that I would die an early age. Of course, we all know scare tactics don't work. Y'all can't hear me back there. And I just figured, you know, that is probably Dad's way of pulling a little deal where he'd get me to straighten up. Even then, I wouldn't listen. I liked what alcohol did for me. I was always very small. I was the youngest in my class at school. I was a minority, and I was raised in Nogales, Arizona, and 85% of our student body was Mexican. It's right on the Mexican border, which is an ideal spot for a budding alcohol to grow up. There's no river, just a fence through town. You just walk across the line. And back then, we could get a shot of tequila for a nickel. We could get a big pitcher of beer for a quarter. And they'd even give you cheese and tostados to go with it. Boy, you couldn't beat it. Jail over there wasn't too swoof, though. They were pretty rough on you. But I experienced some of that before I ever got out of high school. I was a poor student. One reason, we used to sell our books to buy beer. When I was 16, I was supposed to graduate from high school. And they told me that if I would go into the service, that they would graduate me with my class. If I didn't, that I would be held over, have to do that senior year again. So I talked my parents into signing for me, and I went into the Navy when I was 16. Stayed pretty sober in the Navy. We were at sea most of my tour of duty, and they just didn't have any bars out there. But when we were ashore, that was the first order of business. I can remember giving $65 for a fifth of, I don't remember what it was, some kind of rot gut bonded whiskey in the Philippines. We drank sake. Guys, and at this time I always figured, well, I'm not too bad, because we had people on there that, I was on a battleship, and we had scout plane on the fantail, and I have seen them strain that aviation gasoline through a loaf of bread and drink it. They would take the torpedo juice out of the weather vanes and drink that, shoe polish, shaving lotion, anything that had alcohol in it. And I saw just several that they would fly off there to hospitals for going blind and crazy and everything else. So I thought, well, I'll never get like that, you know. Famous last words. But anyhow, when I got out of the service, I didn't do anything, I'll say, for about 2 years, but stayed drunk. My parents had moved to, I believe, Texas then. Might have been Puerto Rico, I don't know. But anyhow, I was footloose and fancy free, and had a little mustering out money. So I didn't figure I needed to work. So I just partied for a couple of years. And then I took up flying on the GI Bill. And my first solo, I tore the man's airplane up, and so that wound up my flying career. But my instructor was an ex-Marine pilot, and we used to take off, and we'd fly about, I don't know, 18 or 20 miles to a place up toward Tucson. Had a little landing strip and a bar, and we would land there, and we'd drink for 2, 3, 4 hours, and we would log that as flying time. But it was just the same thing over and over and over again. And then I got to fooling with rodeo. And the greatest thing about rodeo was the parties that always ensued before and after. I remember, well, this buddy of mine and I, we got pretty fair on those little horses and down in the southwest there, so we decided that we'd just go professional. We'd get up in the Big Apple. And so we did, and we got up in the northwest where they'd have those old horses that weigh 1,600, 1,700 pounds. And they were just too stout for this little boy. And we used to have the saying, you know, chicken today and feathers tomorrow. And we had an old car And back then they had the gas pumps with the bowl on top, and you pump the handle up. I think they held 10 gallons, didn't they, Mary? But at night they would lock that pump handle, but they didn't lock the hoses. And if you made enough service stations and drained the hoses, you could fill up the tank on your car. And this is the way we pretty well got about. We got in several jails around the country during that time. I remember the first rodeo that they held in the Will Rogers Coliseum in Fort Worth. It wasn't even completely finished yet, but it was a 5-day show, and my partner and I, we won something like $1,600, and that was a lot of money back then. And so we called a bunch of car dealers up about midnight from a bar, and the only one we could get to come down was a Ford dealer. So we bought us a new Ford with all the insurance and everything and had money left over. And we drove it about 50 miles, and a Greyhound bus had stopped at a railroad crossing. And I wasn't seeing too good, and I sideswiped that Greyhound bus and wound up out in a cotton patch. And so we got a free ride back to Fort Worth to the jailhouse. But this was, I'm not going to go into a long drunk log, but it was just the same. You know, in here we have a saying, you keep doing what you're doing and you keep getting what you're getting. Well, this was certainly true even back then. And but I could not see that drinking had anything to do with it. We were just having a good time, you know. Fighting and wrecking cars, and that was fun. Now, that's got to be the insanity that they talk about in this fellowship. When you're in jails and hospitals and you keep doing it. Now, I don't know, but that's enough drunkalogue. I moved to Mississippi, let's see, in 1954. And had a little farm over out of Starkville at a place called Bell Schoolhouse. David knows where it is. I stayed there 2 years, and I could not find a solitary soul in Starkville, Mississippi that would take a drink of liquor. Not the first one. So after 2 years, I said, I've got to go somewhere where they've got liquor. So I bought a farm down in Knoxby County. Well, Knoxby County's dry, too, so I just went from bad to worse, I guess. But I got to making corn whiskey down there, supplying hands. One time had about 3 copper rigs, and we were selling that stuff for $8 a gallon and just making all kinds of money. But when I moved down there, everybody I knew in Starkville, Mississippi would come down to Deerbrook and drink my cat whiskey. They love that white whiskey. I didn't get in too much trouble down there, but I drank up that family. My wife was a wonderful person, a beautiful woman, and she gave me 7 children. We buried 2 as infants, and buried a daughter on her 32nd birthday. She died with a brain tumor. She was one of a set of triplets. My wife was in a very serious car wreck. A drunk hit her head on down out of Macon. She lived about a year and then she passed on. I was unable to make amends to her. I tried. And I carried that with me, and I guess to a point I still do. But my sponsor, Ted, told me, said, that God will make amends for you where, in cases like this. He will do anything for you that you ask him to. But of my four living children, none of them will have anything to do with their father. My oldest son told me several years ago that he loved me, but he didn't respect me. You know, that's a bitter pill to swallow, but it comes with acceptance, I guess. And I've gotten ahead of myself here, but I'm not a Fulbright scholar, as you can tell. I just talk as it comes. But I mentioned Ted M., a lot of you knew him. He called on me, I guess it was that 28th of November. He and another gentleman, and I offered him a beer. I'd had a wreck the night before. I hit a parked car, or it jumped out in front of me. I really don't know how it happened, but I had to buy them folks a car. I do know that. I offered them a beer, and they came in. And of course, they declined, and they didn't talk about me. They talked about them. And I had known Ted and had... I'd never drank with him, but I drank with some of his kin folks, and they was damn good drinkers, I want to tell you something. And it wound up, he asked me, would I go to a meeting with him? I said, well, I reckon so. He said, well, I'll pick you up at about 7:30. And so they left, and I got to thinking, now here it is, November 28th, and if I let this man talk me into quitting drinking, I'm going to miss all these Christmas parties and New Year's bashes. And that just didn't seem like a very good idea to me at that time. So when they came to pick him up, I told him, I said, I believe I'm going to put this off till after the first of the year. But thank God he would not hear of that. And I went on and I went to that meeting with him that night at Kern Hall. And I've been to just several meetings since then. Back then, I hated these meetings. I went to a lot of meetings because it was warm in there and you got free coffee. But I used to tell him, I guess for probably some 15, 16 months, that this thing just wasn't working, that I was miserable. And if this is what sobriety is, I don't want any part of it. And he would ask me, have you had a drink today? And I'd say, no, but I sure as hell need one. And he'd say, well, then it's working. And I didn't do anything for over a year but not take a drink. And I can look back now and see that that's probably all I was capable of doing at that point in time. But then he started me on the steps. And even step one gave me a problem. Can you imagine? My perception was such that I still could not see that my life was unmanageable now. And I damn sure didn't want to be an alcoholic. I knew I was a drunk, but I didn't want to be one of y'all alcoholics now. That was a terrible thing. But I worked through that, and I think 2 and 3, Ted led me. I don't know that I was an atheist then, but I was certainly agnostic. I don't know that I believed in God or whether I didn't, but if I did, I no doubt felt that he wouldn't have anything to do with me. But he led me into a spirituality. He used to tell me, now pray. And I didn't know how to pray. And I said, what do I pray to? He said, well, if you don't have a God, you get you a tree or anything. Well, I had a little old tree out in the yard, and that's the way I started praying. I would talk to that tree. But I'd always look around to see if anybody was watching, you know. I was very uncomfortable with even the word God back then. And I know for a good long time, I used to refer to you people as Jesus jumpers. And I would ask myself, what have I gotten into? But I don't think I was alone. I'm satisfied that some of y'all have had the same or similar thoughts in the beginning. But I know without my sponsor having led me into this spirituality by the hand, I would not be sober today. Because I tried many times, and many churches, religions, and it never worked. And I think maybe that was part of my problem, that I could not differentiate between spirituality and religion in the beginning. Today, I have no problem with that. And my animosity toward organized religion is much less than it was 9-plus years ago. Today, I'm comfortable with my God. In fact, I talked to him a good bit this evening coming over here. And I didn't leave Birmingham until 5:30. And I never had a doubt that but what I would get here in time for this meeting. I know William did. Because he was walking up and down the sidewalk when I got here. But to new people, if my story, if you get anything out of it, Just remember when you feel so much despair and worthlessness that if you just hang on and keep coming back, that you'll get on the other side of that. I know I wanted so much to take the easy way out back in that first year, but I didn't, and I'm eternally grateful. My life today is, there is no comparison to what it was in my drinking years. I knew some of y'all, a couple of you anyhow, and you knew me when I was drinking. Bob told me one time, he said, you know, said, I didn't like you when you were drinking, and said, I like you less since you quit drinking. And my wife, that first year, she told me more than once, she said, I wish you'd get drunk. Said, you're a hell of a lot easier to live with drunk than you are trying to sober up. But you know, I guess acceptance to me is the biggest word in the big book. I think at least with my sobriety, everything in my story, my life boils down to how I accept things in my life that I don't like, you know. In my about 45 years of drinking and drunkenness, I didn't do anything what I wanted to do. And today, thanks to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can differentiate between my wants and my needs. Now, I have a lot of wants. I got the same damn wants I had when I was drinking, I guess. But today, I'm able to turn some of those off just because I want them. I know they're not good for me, and I don't believe they're what my God wants me to do. So I'm able to accept that without drinking. And you do this one day at a time, and the more days you put together, the easier it seems to get. But then there's, I guess in everyone's life, there comes that time that, like bananas, just everything falls apart. It just looks like you can't tie ends together. Nothing goes right. But today, when that happens to me, I don't go to the whiskey store. I talk to my God. And I firmly believe that He'll not put any more on me today than He and I can handle. And there's nothing I always like to refer to that billboard. I'm sure y'all have seen it coming east from Starkville. Great big thing. It says that there is nothing wrong in your life that God can't make right. And that is so true. That's so true. That's been proven to me. But you know, everything in my life is not going to always be the way I want it. And that doesn't mean that it's wrong or it's not or it's right or anything else. It's just that I don't want it that way. But then I have to remember that today I have to live in reality. And these old tapes are still up there, you know, that I made those 40-some-odd years of drinking. And as Marion read, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I know you've heard that it's also patient. It'll sit there and wait on you from now on. And all I have to do is pick it up and swallow it. And I'll be right back where I was when I quit. There are those of us that some people call them slips. I ain't never believed that there's such a thing as a slip. Hell, if you drink, you drink because you want to drink. Don't nobody bend that elbow for you. Pour it down you. But there are those that have a difficult time. I know a lot of them. But they keep coming back. I sponsor one fellow that, oh, he was sober, I don't know, or he was dry. He wasn't sober worth a damn, but he was dry 4 or 5 months, and he had to go before the judge. And what did he do? He got drunk the night before. Real smart thinking. But the judge gave him 15 years suspended and I don't know, I think 5 or 7 years probation or something. And he fell another time or two. In fact, when we run out of white chips at the table, I tell him to go home and bring us some down. He's had a few of them. But today he is sober and has some, I believe, 4 years. So when things look despairing, if we'll look around and don't just come to meetings for an hour and then leave everything you hear. I used to sit around when I finally decided that I could talk, you know. I wouldn't talk for a long time at meetings. I'd just pass. And Ted told me, you keep passing, you're going to get drunk again. Well, I talked. I didn't know a damn thing, but I talked. But we have to, you know, and I wasted a lot of time sitting there and you count, you know, well, they'll call on, I got 5 people to think about what I'm going to say when it gets my turn, you know. And so you want to look smart, so you ain't had time to work much on that ego and all these other character defects that I have. I don't know if y'all got them or not, but I know I got them. And I didn't want to appear foolish. And I wanted to make a show, you know. So I wouldn't be listening to what other people were saying. You don't learn like that. You have to listen. I have to listen to what everyone says because I don't care if this is the first day he's been here, he can teach me something. I like to go to the pines as often as I can. We have We have in-house meetings up there. Each or several of us groups. I know my group, I'm a member of Possum Town group. Every third Tuesday we hold an in-house meeting up there. And that takes you back. You put a few days together and sometimes I forget where I came from. But I can go up there and talk to these guys. And it's an experience. This is the first time I've talked in a good while. But you know, and I believe if anybody but William had asked me, I'd have probably declined because I really wasn't too sure that I'd be able to make it. You know, some of us have to work for a living. You know? My sponsor's been dead some 7 years, and he's still teaching me, you know. He used to tell me, don't ever say no. When you're asked to do something in the fellowship, do it. If there's any way humanly possible. So I told my people, a week ago, I also had a 1 year birthday in Columbus Wednesday night. And I made it just about like I did this one tonight, just in the nick of time. But I made it, so that's no big deal, you know. That used to upset me. I like things to fall in place. If I'm supposed to be somewhere at 8 o'clock, I like to get there at least by 9:45, preferably 7:30. But that's all right. There was a time when I would have gotten drunk over something like that. But I really didn't need excuses to get drunk. I just like to drink. I like the way it smelled. I like the way it tasted. I used to love to pour a bunch of it in a coffee cup in the morning. Boy, it'd open up your sinuses. I used to drink a beer before I ever got out of bed. There. In the latter part of my drinking, I'd get up two or three nights to take a drink. I couldn't sleep the night through. And if I'd been on a sure enough good one, when I went to bed, I would open a can of beer and set it by the bed, where when I got up, it'd be about half flat, about room temperature, and I'd drink it. But I remember my favorite breakfast was a beer and a banana. Who but an alcoholic would think of something like that? But since I sobered up, somebody, maybe it's one of my doctor friends, said, well, isn't it potassium that bananas are high in and whiskey deteriorates it, or he drowns it, or something to it. But he said, it's healthy. Bananas are healthy for a drunk. So I was kind of keeping a balance. Every time, if I'd have ate a banana, every time I drank a beer, I might have been a lot healthier than I am today. But as I said, Ted is still teaching me. And you know, it tells me in the big book that nothing will so ensure my sobriety as intensive work with other alcoholics. And this is so true in my life, because I work with several, and many, many times I will be telling a new person something, what suggesting that he do or not do, and boy, that thing go off in that head. Yeah, and that's the same damn thing you ought to do or not do, you know. So it's a continuous learning experience for me. There are tragedies. You know, we all don't make it. In fact, I've heard it said at meetings that someone in this room will die of alcoholism. I have, in my few days in here, I've seen suicide. But you know, it also tells us that some of us have problems other than alcoholism. There's so much information in that big book, you know. Back in the, Ted told me, he said, now start on the very first page, read everything in there. He said, that first page, that fly leaf, you know, he said, that's what you know about staying sober. There ain't nothing on that page. It's just a blank page. But in the preface to the first edition, it says, the purpose of this book is to show precisely how we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that was, what, in 35, wasn't it, Bob?
Published
in 39. And they were 100 men or women strong then. That made a big impression on me, that here in these few short years that there are millions of people worldwide in this fellowship. And it started with just 100. I think of, you know, occasionally we'll have a drunk come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, isn't that unusual? And new people, it just shakes them up, something fierce. What are we going to do? He's drunk. Well, what the hell? We were all drunk when we got here, you know. Make him welcome. Give him a cup of coffee. Tell him to sit down, shut up, and listen. It makes me think of... I can't quote the big book. In fact, I try to keep from it. I've seen too many people do that, get drunk. That's all they do is memorize the big book. But like I said a while ago, we have to practice these principles, just like it. You know, you hear it often said, well, I don't know how it works. And every meeting you read exactly how it works. Simple. But we drunks are too smart for our own good, you know. Results were nil until we let go absolutely. It impressed me in that first paragraph there, where it said, we beg you. Did you ever hear a drunk beg anybody for anything? I didn't. I never begged. I ask them a lot of time, please quit beating on my head. But don't give up before the miracle happens. And if you do the do, it does work. It does work. And I'm long-winded. I don't want to get over. I left my glass on the table. I believe I said 9 o'clock. Man, you should have told me to shut up. But I do thank you. I'm not as long-winded as you are, Bob. For inviting me here. And I wish the birthday boys many happy returns. God bless you.
Run tape to end before playing other side.